This was right. This was normalcy. This was health. This was being alive. If he wanted to be open to life, health, normalcy, rightness, he also had to be open to the decision, commit himself to it, act on it. Because the decision was based upon decisions made by everybody, everywhere, a long, long time ago, in the beginning. And those decisions, once made, determined how everything worked, life, health, defined normalcy. And if one, anyone, did not act basically within those deductions, or acted against them, or decided something else, then legs, which hold us up, support us, permit basic movement, progress, shatter, and shortly we are sitting in the dust, all of us, corrupt and cracked-headed, corrupting, awaiting the jackals. Tired, rising from the cot, dizzy at first, Fletch stood a moment sucking in the jungle air, heavy with rain. He could smell the jungle, the rotting roots and the slashed green leaves. He could hear the noises of the animals as they moved around in their world, acting with indecisions, what was normal, what was health, what was life for them. Making choices is the ultimate freedom in a world in which decisions have been made to permit such freedom. Failure to see that sometimes no choice can be made, that there is no personal decision, is the ultimate folly, the absolute destruction of self and all. Fletch took the wet towel and tucked it around his waist. Pushing aside the tent flap, he looked outside. There were signs of dawn in the sky. The rain was a nearly solid, straight-down torrent, hitting so hard it made the ground look almost jumping. From which direction was the sound of two men talking coming? Two men talking loudly over the sound of rain, in English, laughing. Listening through the opened tent flap just inside his tent, Fletch could not make out what they were saying. A tent across the way, newly put up, showed dim light around the edges of its flap. Unsteadily, the rain beating on him, feeling good, feeling weary, feeling fresh, feeling slightly dizzy, Fletch splashed and slithered across the campsite, mud, barefooted. Do I have to do this? Am I sure I have nothing to decide? The decision has been made. We exist within context. That is our first, our only, our last decision. Making choices is the ultimate freedom. There is no freedom without basic decisions having been made. Self-discipline is the greatest exercise of freedom. He pulled aside the tent flap and looked in. Inside, Peter Carr and Walter Fletcher sat in canvas, wood-framed camp chairs. Each had a glass in hand. On the box beside the kerosene lamp was a nearly empty bottle of whiskey. They stopped talking. They stared at Fletch. The lines in their faces moved up from around their mouths to around their eyes. Fletch said to Walter Fletcher, "Thanks for coming to the airport to meet us." Chapter 39. The two men sitting in the tent staring up at Fletch through the dim light of the kerosene lamp said nothing. "Do you speak Portuguese?" Fletch asked the man with the thinning, combed hair, pencil mustache. "What do you mean?" asked Walter Fletcher. Fletch stood just inside the open tent flap. Behind him, rain poured with a steady roar. "I saw you," Fletch said, "at the airport, in the men's room." "Oh, my God." Carr sat forward in his camp chair. "Say it isn't so." On the box beside Carr, next to the kerosene lamp, next to the whiskey bottle, were the pottery shard and the Roman coin. Walter Fletcher stared full-eyed at Fletch. He put his whiskey glass on the box. He resettled himself in his chair. Ankles crossed, boot heels in the mud, hands folded in his lap, for a long moment Walter Fletcher studied Fletcher's face. Slack-jawed, Carr was staring at Walter Fletcher. For only a second, Walter Fletcher glanced at Carr. Then he looked at Fletch for another long moment. "Well." Abruptly, Walter Fletcher stood up. His boots were flat in the mud. He patted down the pockets of his safari jacket. Using both hands, he smoothed back his hair from his temples. Chin up, not looking into Fletch's face, he brushed by Fletch. He walked out of the tent into the storm. "Where's he going?" Fletch asked. "Nowhere he can go." Carr remained hunched over in his camp chair. "What a box of rocks. All this time you've been thinking the murderer at the airport could have been Walter Fletcher. Fletch shrugged. The murderer was a local who came to meet someone at the airport, whom he did not meet. Don't you think you'd better sit down? Jesus, Carr! What now? Fletch had heard an airplane engine ignite. Carr had not. They both heard the roar of the engine as gasoline was pushed into it. Carr jumped up. Together, Fletch and Carr stood outside the tent, looking through the heavy rain in the dawn across the campsite at the yellow airplane with green swooshes. The cockpit lights went off. The wing and tail lights were on. The airplane was turning around over the rough, wet ground. Wings rocking, it skittered around Carr's plane and jounced onto the landing track. "A plane that light can't take off in this heavy rain," Fletch shouted. "Can it?" The glass in Carr's hand had a centimeter of rainwater in it already. Carr said, "I wouldn't try it." The airplane almost made it. It splashed and swayed down the track. Its engine roared through the sound of the rain. Throwing water behind it, it lifted off the track. It rose against the tree line. For a moment, it looked as if it were above the treetops. The left wing dipped. The plane fell. The plane's left wing cracked against the top of a tree. The treetop shook. The tip of the wing fell into the woods. As if pivoting, engine roaring, the plane swung left around the top of the tree. Then only the undercarriage of the tail of the airplane was visible against the sky. From the woods, it was not a crash, but a thud. Instantly, flame was visible through the undergrowth. Carr thrust his glass into Fletch's hand. "I'll go. You're in no condition." Carr ran splashing through the rain. "The flames, Carr!" Fletch threw the glass aside. He ran, tripping over the wet ground, slipping in the mud. Fletch hadn't gotten far when he fell, face down in the mud. He tried to get up quickly. His head felt cement. Pain shot from his right shoulder. Weak from his days of fever, his arms and legs flailed the mud uselessly. He lay stomach on the ground a moment, his right cheek, ear in the mud, just breathing. He watched air bubbles in the mud break open. Chapter 40. Rain-soaked, muddy from head to foot, a cut bleeding on his forearm, Carr entered Fletch's tent. Carr shook his head. No. Fletch was sitting on the edge of his cot. Mud ran down his face, the front of his body, his chest, his stomach, into the sodden towel around his waist, down his legs, into the mud at his feet. "How many words did my father speak to me?" "He's a pretty poor-looking specimen, isn't he?" "No, these were not words spoken to me, but about me." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well." 5 words. My father spoke 5 words to me, in my life, in his life, in our lives. I had no decision to make. The basic decision ordering how people behave, for survival, the social contract, was made a long, long time ago. Carr, he was trying to get away, wasn't he? Who knows, Carr said. Who cares? My mother said he was apt to evade moments of emotional intensity. How do you feel? Like being hung from the neck. In the dim kerosene light, Carr watched Fletch from across the tent. He finally died in an air crash, in a storm, not in Montana, but in Africa. Presumed dead. The courts made a presumption which was almost right. All this noise apparently hasn't awakened anybody. The sound of the rain. Yes, the sound of the rain. How did he get to be here? I'd never heard. You've been pretty sick. Were the charges against him dropped? All that was a joke already. Another funny story. The Askari had no official standing. He was just an unlicensed guard from a jewelry store across the street. So Walter was released from custody after paying a fine, damages to the Thorn Tree Cafe, the Askari's hospital expenses, plus a few shillingi to make up for the weight the Askari gained in the hospital. I came halfway around the world to put my father out into a storm, to see him killed in an air crash. Poetry. Erwin. Yes, Carr. I know you can't be feeling like a calisthenics director on a spring morning. How I spent my honeymoon. This is Tuesday. The plane leaves for London tonight. I think you and Barbara should be on it.
Yes?
As soon as the weather clears, I'll fly you up to Nairobi. Book your seats.
Okay.
Fletch fingered mud from his eyes.
Anything you say. You've been a real friend, Carr. Thank you.
Enough of that. I thank you. If it weren't for the intelligence of you and Barbara and Juma, we never would have found the world's latest ruin.
Having found it will make a big name for you, Peter Carr.
Yes. I want to go to Nairobi today and report the find, show the evidence, turn the whole dig over to the scientific wallahs. After discovering the place, I don't want to be accused of messing it up.
Right. Discover, but do not meddle. Be committed, but not involved.
Also, of course, I have to report the death of Walter Fletcher to the authorities, get them down here.
Yes.
In the meantime, we still have the problem of the police accusing someone innocent of murder. Fletch looked up at Carr's solidity.
We're not going to report Walter Fletcher was the murderer?
Not unless we have to. Why should we? Why totally wreck the name Walter Fletcher? It's a small world.
You're thinking of me.
If it looks like they're going to hang the wrong bag, you'll come forward.
Of course.
Then there'd be a reason for coming forward.
Maybe it will be an unsolved crime. But Dan Dawes, this morning you might write out an eyewitness account, beginning in the men's room at the airport, including the events of this morning.
Maybe I'll show it to Dan Dawes.
Okay.
If the authorities come even close to indicting someone else for the murder, I'll hand your account in officially, see if they want to bring you back to testify.
Sounds like the best thing to do, I guess.
I'll get you some paper and a pen. A spot of tea might go well about now, too.
Carr, why are Barbara and I leaving so soon? Why are we leaving tonight?
Across the tent, still standing, ignoring the cut on his arm, Carr looked at Fletch without expression.
I'm thinking about a funeral. My father, the excitement of the discovery...
The air crash would be investigated, Carr said. The authorities will be here. University people will come to see the ruins, the press. They'll all be here by tonight.
So what?
Carr took a step closer to Fletch. Even in that dawn's light, Carr's eyes were clear, blue. Quietly, he said, Don't you suspect your passports are phonies?
At Los Angeles Airport, looking into her passport, Barbara had said, Where did this picture of me come from?
Fletch had never seen his passport picture before, either.
Well, I know we didn't apply for them ourselves.
Carr nodded.
I've heard all the news.
Wet, bedraggled, Barbara stood inside Fletch's tent.
Propped up on the cot, the kerosene lamp pulled close to him, Fletch was writing out his account of the murder of Louis Ramon and the death of Walter Fletcher in an air crash during a storm.
Before starting, he had showered most of the mud off him in the rain.
My father did not die in childbirth.
Barbara said,
I don't know how I feel about it.
How you feel?
No.
She continued to stand a meter away from him. Sweat, humidity. Fletch was having difficulty keeping the paper dry to write.
We need to get packed, Fletch said. We're starting home tonight. Once we came here to camp, we never really unpacked, just underwear.
I guess we don't need to pack the torn sweaters and cut off ski pants.
I'll hang them from the trees. Maybe the monkeys will wear them. Suits them.
Still, we must repack.
It's not as if I'm overburdened with souvenirs.
You have some memories for the long ride.
I never even sent my mother a postcard.
You can send her one from home. Where's Carr?
In his tent. He's writing something, too.
His version of events.
He says he thinks it will clear up enough for us to take off at noon.
Fletch looked out through the tent flap Barbara had left askew. Can't take off in this rain, Barbara said.
So I heard.
Chapter 41.
Your father was a murderer.
Barbara was buckling herself into her airplane seat aboard the midnight flight to London from Nairobi.
Won't your mother love that? Think of all the books she's written looking for the murderer.
Fletch was already buckled into his seat. He sighed. He said nothing.
He had a long way to go with the other passengers aboard. He had a long way to go with Barbara. After they were airborne and the no-smoking sign went off, and the stewardesses demonstrated to the passengers what to do if the airplane ditched and the fastened seatbelt light went off, the voice over the public address system said, "Will passenger Fletcher please identify himself, Mr. I.M. Fletcher?" Building a nest for herself in her seat, clearly Barbara did not hear the request. Fletcher took a deep breath and closed his eyes. "Don't you suspect your passports are phonies?" More trouble could wait. The rain had not lightened enough for them to take off from the camp until afternoon. Packing the airplane, Carr made lame jokes about the skis. No one looked down the runway track to where an airplane had crashed that morning, burned itself up, where there was still a corpse. There was a goodbye scene of mixed emotion. The workmen, including Winston and Raffles, said goodbye individually. Sheila had hugs and kisses for Fletch, Barbara, and Juma. They were all sad to be parting, sad to be standing near a terrible death, yet each quite glad that something sought at great expense had been found, that a historic discovery had been made, and that each had been part of it. Nor did Fletch look down for the burn hole in the woods as they took off. He did not put on his new white sneakers, courtesy of the Norfolk Hotel, until they landed at Wilson Airport. Juma and Carr helped him with their luggage to the international airport. Juma stood with them while Carr took their return ticket to the airline counter. The few people who were in the airport at that hour looked curiously at the skis. Fletch said to Juma, "Nice time." Juma's head tilted. "Sorry." "You have seats on tonight's flight." Their tickets and boarding passes were in Carr's hand when he returned. "You have to take your luggage through customs yourself. Do you have any Kenyan money? You have to turn it in." Both Barbara and Fletch dug out the few Kenyan shillings they had and handed them to Juma. Laughing, they both said, "No." Money in hand, Juma bent over laughing. Carr said, "I'm afraid you'll have to wait a long time. The plane doesn't leave until midnight." "We'll be all right," Fletch said. "I need to sit down." "You feel all right on the flight?" "Sure, I need a rest." "Well..." Carr looked around the nearly empty terminal. "There are things I must go do," Fletch said. "I understand." "One happy, one sad." "You'll arrange for a funeral," Barbara said. Carr hesitated. "Oh, yes." Fletch said, "Carr, Peter Carr, we thank you." "No, no." Turning away, his face reddened, Carr waved down Fletch's speech. "Don't embarrass us." Barbara said, "Thank you, Peter Carr." Fletch hugged Juma. "I'll see you on television, kid." "See you on the funnies pages." While Barbara hugged Juma, Fletch hugged Carr. Then there was a general shaking of hands all round. "Bye," Carr said. "Fletch?" Fletch said to Juma, "Friends?" "Why not?" Juma asked. "Nice time." Fletch tilted his head. The wait at the terminal seemed interminable. Barbara read magazines. Fletch thought over the account of the murder of Louis Ramone and the death of Walter Fletcher he had written and handed Carr. Slowly it dawned on him that he had another story to write. A story much better than the stories of avalanches, mudslides, major earthquakes, airplane crashes, train wrecks, mass murders, airport bombings. Frank Jaffe had requested. He had the story to write of Sheila and Peter Carr, the story of their historic discovery of the ruins of an ancient Roman city on the east coast of Africa. After thinking about it, Fletch decided he would not mention to Barbara just yet that he would get a story for the newspaper out of their honeymoon. Barbara nudged him. "That's you." "What's me?" "They just paged you. Would passenger I.M. Fletcher please identify himself," she just said. "Oh." Fletch raised his hand. There were people milling about in the aisles. "Maybe we get a free bottle of champagne," Barbara said. "That would be nice."
"You're always hoping."
"Mr. Fletcher?"
"Yes."
The stewardess handed him a letter. "Mail delivery in midair?" he asked. "Someone sent it aboard requesting that it be delivered to you after takeoff. Would you like a drink?"
"No, thanks."
Opening the envelope, Fletch said to Barbara, "It's from Carr." "Oh, no champagne." The letter read, "Dear Irwin, the plan was that after meeting and greeting you and your bride, The man Walter Fletcher and I were going to take you aside and quietly explain ourselves. Instead, the man Fletcher understood he was to meet you at International Airport and got himself into his own trouble, as you and I both know. As you now must realize, the Kenyan government takes their official documents very seriously indeed. With the man Fletcher in jail, I suddenly saw him and you and Barbara as loose cannons careening around the deck. Forgive me, but I think you can understand I did not want my particular ship to sink, not at this point in my life. The facts are these. I was in Kenya at the time English colonists had the choice of either going back to England or of turning their English passports in for Kenyan citizenship. I'd flown planes in Chile, Australia, Colombia, then here. Even I had come to the point where I wanted to be a part of somewhere, of Kenya. While in Colombia, I had faked out heavy smuggler types, causing several to be shot, and they'd proven slow to forgive. Occasionally, therefore, odd people would appear looking for me, and I'd have to go hide in the bush until they went away. This was inconvenient. Always when they left, they would leave the message that they would keep looking until they found me. At the same time, Peter Carr had heavy debts he couldn't pay, both in England and in France. I never inquired too deeply into the nature of his difficulties, but I believe they were severe. Peter was English, I American. With only a little doctoring, during those days of official confusion, we switched passports, my American for his British, which I turned in for Kenyan. People who subsequently came looking for Walter Fletcher found Carr and did not shoot him. People who came looking for Peter Carr found me and left me similarly intact. Thus we lived peacefully for years. I realized I was taking a risk in inviting you and your bride here, but one I thought we could survive. I was only half right. I don't deserve to be reported well to your mother, I suppose. We are grown-up people now. For each other, we can never be children again. We were children when we married. There was a storm the night in Montana I took off to fly home, just having had the news of your birth. But I never saw the storm. I landed at a small closed airport just before dark. See in your mind's eye, if you can, a boy, a teenager, sitting in the cockpit of his airplane at the end of a runway of a small closed Montana airfield, a blizzard raging a few miles ahead of him, a very young husband who had just been told he was a very, very young father, shivering, feeling, thinking. More than my feet were cold. It was not Josie, my wife, I was rejecting. It was not you, Irwin Morris, my son, I was rejecting, despite your moniker. I was rejecting myself that night, the idea of myself as husband and father. That night I knew, as an absolute certainty, that I would be a terrible father, a terrible husband, a total disappointment, that I would cause more pain than we all could stand. There was no doubt in that boy's mind, sitting in the dark, shivering in the cockpit, that you would be better off without me. I could have flown into the side of a mountain that night. I didn't. For us all, I took the next option. Disappear, get out of your lives, go have my own accidents without you as victims. 2 days later in British Columbia, I read of my probable demise. I left it at that. Even so, I know I have caused you both much pain. Through the International Brotherhood of Flying Buddies, I have had occasional reports, photographs of each of you. You've done okay without me. Better, I think, than you would have done with me. The history of my achieving my present maturity would gray the hair and crack the spine of even the most casual but consistent observer. I've barely survived it myself. If you cannot report well of me to your mother, someday you might let her know I read her books as love letters I don't deserve. To you, my son, I offer a simple, sustaining thought. One mellows. I appreciate your having enough mild curiosity to come and see me. Chapter 42. The last chapter. What astounded Fletch was that the letter written to him was signed Fletch. This concludes the reading of Fletch 2 by Gregory MacDonald. This book was read by Grover Gardner. Additional titles by Gregory MacDonald in the Books on Tape library include Carioca Fletch and Fletch and the Widow Bradley. For additional information about them or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department or check our catalog index to find review material. Will you please wind or rewind the tape as appropriate so the book will be in order for the next person to enjoy? Thank you.